I am so excited to share with you guys my love for Catbird NYC, one of my favorite makers of jewelry on the planet. A few years ago, I was exploring Williamsburg, Brooklyn for the first time, and I happened to walk into this really sweet brick and mortar store, and I looked around and I saw that it was filled with the most delicate, beautiful, sparkly jewelry, all of which seemed like if I dreamed up a line or a type of jewelry, this would be it. I'm the kind of person that wears the same jewelry to go swimming in the morning that I wear to a formal wedding that same night. The thing about the jewelry that they make at Catbird is that it is jewelry that has this ease of wear and this sort of quietness that just slips into your life, and you can put their jewelry on and you never take it off. And the thing that they became super popular for originally are these stacking rings, like these beautiful, delicate 14 karat gold stacking rings that you can layer and have this really delicate aesthetic. So if you're gonna spend money on something that you want but don't really need, do it with Catbird, because it is an investment in yourself. You'll feel confident and beautiful in Catbird jewelry. Go to catbirdnyc.com.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. He's a lot of end friends with some revelations. Little known back to the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday, and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind-the-scenes photos, videos, and interviews, and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. I'm so excited to share today's episode with you guys with Joe Iconis and Jennifer Ashley Tepper. I had the great pleasure of sitting down with them both at BroadwayCon 2018. It'll be very clear we're at BroadwayCon, not just because we referenced it, but you can hear it in the background all through the episode. And I hope that just makes it all the more fun to listen to. But something really extraordinary has happened since I spoke with Joe and Jen, which is the musical Be More Chill, which both of them have been involved in from the very beginning, was meant to come to New York. Then those plans got thwarted. And then because of the passion, enthusiasm, and the demand of the Be More Chill fans, it's happening. And it really is kind of a musical theater, modern day miracle. And even more ironic is while I was editing the episode today, my son was creating a recording of his own of one of the songs from Be More Chill, Michael in the Bathroom. And it really moved me and really, I don't know, nailed the point home about how musicals can speak to a young person and they can find themselves and connect to it in ways that are really magic. And he just walked in with the recording, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to share it. because it is pure love for Be More Chill. Anyway, here's my son Caleb, a little snippet of his recording of Michael in the Bathroom. And then it gives me great, great pleasure to bring you Joe Iconis and Jennifer Ashley Tepper on this episode of Little Known Facts. Enjoy.
Michael in the Bathroom by himself.
Hey everybody, we are here at Broadway Con 2018 with Jen Tepper and Joe Iconis. Joe Iconis is a Long Island native and a grad of the great NYU Tisch Graduate Musical Theater Program. He is the recipient of a zillion awards for his musical theater genius. Some of his musicals include The Black Suits, Rewrite, The Plant That Ate Dirty Socks, Things to Ruin, the songs of Joe Iconis, and his Christmas music extravaganza that Will Roland basically talks about in his sleep. And that musical's fandom and the family of people who participate in that musical is growing and growing and growing. And more artists are joining every year. And the passionate fan base is kind of extraordinary. With us, his partner in crime, Jennifer Ashley Tepper, who is the creative and programming director at Feinstein's 54 Below. She's the author of the Untold Stories of Broadway book series. She's also produced Broadway shows, most recently The Parisian Woman, starring Uma Thurman, and she produces the work of her dear friend, Joe Iconis. Welcome, Joe and Jen, to the podcast.
Hi, Alana.
Hey.
Okay, first of all, it's a little like there's a lot of ambient noise, which I think people at home and listeners will be like, wow, it's like we're at Broadway Con.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm glad that we're getting to share that with them. But the thing that I want to know, this is a little like the newlywed game, old school. Like, you guys are often mentioned in the same sentence together, even though independently you have accomplished huge things. There's a relationship here that people are very curious about. So can you share with me a little bit of where this magic began?
Yeah. Tepper, do you want to take it?
Sure. We can do it together. But I was so obsessed with Joe from the first time I heard his songs. And I thought, that person is just writing musical theater that I have to be a part of in some way. So I worked on the musical title of show on Broadway as the director's assistant. And one of our title of show producers was producing a show of Joe's called Things to Ruin. And I said, let me be your producing assistant. I love this guy's stuff. It's like my favorite new musical theater being written. And she invited me to do that. And that's where we started working together. And from there, he just like can't get rid of me. I've been lucky enough to work on a lot of his musicals, a lot of his concerts in different capacities, and I just think he's writing the best stuff today.
Well, can I ask you something, Joe, before you speak? How did you hear the music? Like, before title of show, and then you found out this
First internship in New York at the York Theater, I was cataloging demos for fun because it was a job no one wanted to do. The demos that they had in a dusty pile in the closet, not because they weren't good, but just because the York is a little dusty and wonderful. And Joe had a demo in that pile, and I listened to Helen, which is a song of his. I listened to Blue Hair, and I was like, this is the best stuff ever.
Okay, so that was like the magic moment where you happened to be cleaning, and look what happened. Do you remember the first time you met Tepper?
I do. The first time I literally met Tepper was after a concert of mine at the Beachman. You know, as you said, I do these Iconis and family shows, these, you know, sort of nights of my songs that are in between like a rock show and a cabaret. And Tepper, I guess, had been to a few unbeknownst to me. And then finally, after I guess a few times of her coming, she came up after a show and just sort of introduced herself. And that sort of started the whole thing, you know. And throughout my career, I've had so many long collaborations, so many collaborations that have sort of, you know, lasted for a while. And it's always hard for me to remember exactly when those people like came into my life, you know.
So.
It's hard to think back, to think of like, oh, how did our relationship and our collaboration progress? It sort of feels like there's never been a time without Tepper, you know, which is nice.
And I also feel like after a year, like we met, it was kind of 2008 when we started seeing each other. And then by 2009, we were like working on everything together. And we were like putting on a concert in Bryant Park together and carrying like a keyboard through, the, you know, 34th Street. Like it happened really fast. And then it was just, it stuck.
You were young, scrappy, and hungry together.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, I've had the great privilege of having Jen on my podcast, and I hope that I'll get you also on my podcast in a more intimate setting than the Javits Center. Or not. Maybe we'll find that this is where I want to do all of my interviews from now on.
This is our new thing.
This might be like, come to the Javits. Like, there's a boat show. Let's go do an interview.
There's literally a boat show right now.
There's literally a boat show.
Yeah.
Let's go. We
should
do it there.
There's always a boat show.
There's always on yachts.
Yeah.
Which are two things that people don't generally think of together, but we're changing that. So I know a little bit about Jen's growing up in Miami mm-hmm. and sort of the ways in which, by the way, shout out to Jen Tepper's mom, who's right here. Do you want to just say a quick hello
Hi,
to the microphone, Janice? People want to know the source of Jen Tepper. It's you.
Hi.
I want to ask you, and then we'll move it back to Jen and Joe. Were you a musical theater lover growing up?
I was a huge theater lover growing up, and I took Jennifer to a lot of shows and made sure she went to theater camp. And now I get to love theater through her on a different level than ever before.
That is pretty extraordinary. So it all started a generation before.
My mom's here, you guys.
I mean, thank you. Thank you for a special guest star, Mrs. Tepper. So that's how it starts, right? Mm-hmm. What about for you?
So as we said, I'm from Long Island originally, and my family is not in the arts at all. Like, there's no one in my family who's really into theater or the arts in any way, right? And I sort of came to theater through Little Shop of Horrors because the movie came out when I was a little kid, and I loved the movie so much, and the original production was still running when that movie came out.
Okay.
It was running for like a few more months. And so I saw a commercial for it, and I was like, oh, that's that movie I love. I want to see that. And so for my 6th birthday, my dad took me to see the original production of Little Shop at the Orpheum. It was like, I think, a month before it closed or something. And I was like hooked. Like, it was the most like TV movie of the week version of a kid falling in love with theater. You know, I was completely like enraptured. At the end of that production, like vines came down on the audience.
Yeah,
and
they did.
I truly think it, like, in that moment, it was like, it like zapped musical theater into me, you know? And so then, like, from then on, I was just obsessed with it. And my family was so supportive. They were so kind, even though they didn't fully understand it, you know? Because everyone in my family, like my mom's side of the family is from Brooklyn, my dad's side's from Queens, and so like they would go to theater casually, but no one was like obsessed with it. And then all of a sudden, I was this little kid who was like obsessed with theater, and they were so supportive. And so for every like birthday, holiday, the gift was always like going to see a show. And so I saw a ton of stuff when I was a kid, and it really sort of formed my my sensibility and my love of the whole thing.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger brother who's 4 years younger, and he's a middle school social studies teacher. A lot of people in my family are teachers. That's sort
is
of
that
like
what your parents
the
did?
Family business. My mom is a superintendent of schools on Long Island.
Wow.
And my dad's in computers. So he's the weird one.
So did you grow up like hearing about the politics of public schools in New York and
Yeah. I mean, that was just sort of like that was my everyday life, you know, and I have a lot of like extended family members who are teachers, and it was just kind of that, you know. It was that, and then my grandpa, when I was a little kid, owned a bar or restaurant, and so like that was the other side, you know, like that sort of like. And my grandma owned a beauty parlor, and so there was like that and teaching, and that was my life as a little kid.
Okay, but not for nothing, being a superintendent of schools is a really big deal,
it's
and
a
it's
crazy
not
job.
Something you start at. Like that is, was she a principal beforehand?
Oh yeah, yeah. She was.
So
a,
she went.
She was a classroom teacher for many years, then assistant principal, and now she's superintendent of Massapequa Schools on Long
Lucille
Island.
Iconis. She's really like Lucille. A superhero.
She really is.
She's a superintendent superhero.
Yes. Yeah.
I wish she were here so that both your moms could have cameo appearances on Little Known
really.
Facts. So there's something amazing and special about having someone in a family who has a passion that kind of can hold the whole family hostage
mm-hmm.
in a certain way. And it seems like for both of you, the luck of being born into families that not only got it, but were like, what can we do? What can we do to help you move it forward? And then you both ended up at the NYU school, but not at the same time. Is that correct? There's an
not
age
at the
difference?
Same time.
Or
what's really cool is I feel like Joe and I both surround ourselves with these like chosen families, but our actual families are integrated into that.
Yeah.
Yes.
My sister, Jessica Kent, actually works for Joe as one of his lawyers now. So it's all in the family.
Which is my dream. My dream is to have like everyone that I work with and who I am actually related to just all be like the same group of people, you know?
So what was the first musical that you wrote that got done somewhere?
The first show that I wrote that got done somewhere was The Black Suits. That was my thesis musical at NYU. And so that was the first full-length musical I ever really wrote. You know, I wrote like little things throughout school, but that was my first full-length. And and that sort of got me attention immediately out of school and sort of set me on a path.
So coincidentally,
yeah.
A month before The Black Suits went to the Barrington
mm-hmm.
Stage Theater Company.
Barrington Stage Company.
Thank you.
You're close.
I'm a little formal. I call it the Barrington Theater. I did a play with Ben Platt.
and he played my son.
Oh, right.
And the show was done, and he was like, I'm going to the Berkshires to go do a musical. And he and my family became so close, and my little daughter thought of him as a big brother, that he was like, can you bring Georgia, and can you come see this show? And so we drive, we do a mommy-daughter trip to go see this play. Julie Platt, the beloved mother of Ben Platt, shout-outs to Mom, who also I worship at the altar of, like, how do you raise the most balanced, well-rounded, grounded children? You call Julie Platt, just by the way, anybody listening. And so we go, and it's like one of the most meaningful trips I've taken with my little girl. And at the end of the show, someone gets hit.
Yeah.
And my kid is wrecked. She is like, literally, we're supposed to like go hang out and like spend the evening with Ben. She can't.
No.
It's completely like, is he really hurt? Is everyone okay? Because someone got punched. Yeah. And it was like the
Joe
most...
needs to have blood in all of his
I
musicals.
I know. It's my insistence on blood that wrecked your poor kid.
It was just one of those moments where she was so invested in the story and those characters, and also loving Ben so much, like a brother, and seeing him in like a scary, painful moment on stage. But sort of it ended up being a great springboard for conversation, like reality and not reality.
Sure,
he's not really hurt. And like him showing her like, this is how the stuff. Like, literally, like, you go, like, anyway. But I remember that, like, it was yesterday.
Wow.
But beyond that, beyond my personal experience with it, that was a great show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
And then to see Will and Ben again and Dear Evan Hansen, and knowing that for them, it made them feel safer on the first day of rehearsal because they had that history because of you.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
I love it. Yeah, it's such a wild thing.
But when you say, like, I got attention for it right away, just because so many people are out there plugging away and no one's giving them attention right away for their musical. How did that like magic dust get sprinkled on you at that time?
You know, it's sort of a strange thing. And Black Suits had a very kind of brambly path to a stage. You know, it was my first show that I wrote, but from the time I graduated school, it was 7 years probably, 7-8 years maybe, until that Barrington production. You know. And so so Black Suits was my thesis musical at NYU. At NYU, there's some amazing adjunct professors who sort of come through, and we had some commercial producers who came through, and the great Bill Finn is
whose song
on the
is playing in the background
there.
Right now, Heart of Music. I just have to say that.
Why does that keep happening? When we first started, there was a song, The Big Chill, from The Big Chill was playing, or what was playing when we first
Broadway Here I Come
was
playing.
Here I Come, sorry. Yeah. The Big Chill, great movie.
Yeah, I know.
You wrote that?
Yes,
that's
I did.
Amazing.
I wrote The Great Big Chill. Yes.
Kevin Costner was cut out, and I'm sure you were upset
that was
about
my fault. When I was two, I was talking to Lawrence Kasdan about cutting Costner out of The Big Chill. So a bunch of people sort of heard it and were exposed to it. And I think it was just one of those, like, right show at the right time for people, because it was right before Spring Awakening opened. There wasn't really things, like, being written that had, like, a youthful voice and about young people. And so I think people were excited by that. And it kind of got me some attention. And so I ended up, and I'm totally, like, you know, blessed, and it was a magic situation. I ended up at a nonprofit theater in development with this musical, which I sort of assumed was going to mean that my musical would be, you know, off Broadway in a year, and then beyond Broadway the year after that on the strength of great reviews, and then I'd win a Tony Award and like the movie version. And I sort of thought, okay, this will be like a 3-year process to me having like a perfectly comfortable, beautiful life in the American musical theater. And as soon as I was, you know, a year or two into development with the show, I was like, oh, wait a minute, that's not actually how this works. And I ended up not doing the show at that theater that it was in development at, which is something that happens all the time. But in the meantime, I was like, oh, I'm a writer, and I want my songs to be heard, and I want to just put on shows. And so the thing that sort of gave me my whole career was actually not the Black Suits. It was me doing shows and doing concerts. And I was like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to like put on a theater piece that involves my material, but like I'm sure that someone does. And so I met with a bunch of theater companies, and there was a director who I knew from NYU who I wasn't like tight with, but I was friendly with, and he directed some stuff that I loved. His name is John Simpkins, and I was like, I really love that John Simpkins guy from NYU. Maybe he could direct this thing. And he directed directed my first show, and we've since become like great friends and like very close collaborators. And he directed Black Suits. And
yes, because when Will Roland was on the podcast, he said that one of the magical teachers, which we need in our lives to kind of take us along, was John.
Oh yeah.
And a few times he found himself mentioning that name, and he was like, "Oh, he's like a fairy godfather to me." He's
exactly.
Do you know John as well?
I love John, and actually, I was obsessed with all of his shows at NYU. I was not a performance major, and I would just like go see them over and over. And I saw one of my best friends, Joe's wife, Lauren Marcus, play Mary and Merrily over and over before we were friends.
Your favorite
show. Like, obsessed with her in it and the show and John's direction. And then like John and Joe are longtime collaborators on all these musicals. So we've gotten to like work on shows like Blood Song of Love and, you know, Black Suits and all that stuff together now.
And did you meet your wife at NYU?
I saw her at NYU. I saw her in that production of Merrily, and that was the first time that I ever that was the first time I ever saw her playing Mary and Merrily, and I was like immediately smitten. You know, it was like
she was
like,
so good that he married her.
Who is that actor? Yeah. I always say that I'm like the best. That's such a success story for like obsessed fans. You know, because I truly was like straight up obsessed fan, and now we're married.
How does that happen? Like, how do you go from stalker to lover?
How I went from stalker to lover. Was
it's not the same for everyone,
It's not the same for everyone, but my path for the listeners.
Yeah.
It was I really was into her as an actor. You know, I love actors. I'm like a huge fan of great actors. I love writing for actors. And so I saw as much as I could of her stuff, right? Of her performances. And then one day I was doing a reading of The Black Suits, an actor dropped out the morning of the reading, and I was like, I need someone immediately. I'm gonna call that Lauren Marcus girl who I've never met to come and be in this reading and see if she'll do it, you know? And so she always talks about how the first time that we ever really communicated, she got a message from me, and I apparently said, "Hi, Lauren, this is Joe Iconis. I'm a big fan of yours. Somebody dropped out of this reading. If you want to fill in, I would love to have you, but just know that if you don't call me back in the next 20 minutes, I have to ask somebody else."
Nice.
You know, that was like my first.
So you could have been married to somebody else.
I could have, yeah. It's horrifying. It could have been that next, I don't remember who was the next person on the list, but thank God she called back and said that she would do it.
Thank God.
Yeah,
thank
really.
God. And the rest is history.
The rest is history.
And did you already know her, Jen?
You know, I was kind of fans of everybody before I became friends and collaborators with them. Like, I was a fan of Lauren's, and I was a fan of Joe's separately. And then the weird thing about NYU is it's so big that you kind of see a lot of people that you don't necessarily meet until later.
Yeah.
So what was the first thing that you guys sort of officially collaborated on?
You know, so I got to work on Things to Ruin as kind of like the producer's assistant, but really I feel like the first thing we worked on more in depth was Blood Song of Love, which was Joe's musical that played Ars Nova in 2010. And I just got to do a ton of like audience outreach and marketing. And it was like such it's one of my favorite musicals ever. And it was such a like remarkable experience to kind of like work on it in that way. I feel like we had a thing where once the show was running, we saw like almost every performance together.
How many performances were there at the time?
It was
a month and a half.
Six weeks.
Yeah.
So I know that you guys are collaborating on, maybe I don't know this. Are you involved in his production of the next musical that's happening now?
Yeah. Joe's show, in collaboration with director John Simkins at Penn State, that's coming up, Love and Hate Nation, I'm actually going to be the dramaturg on it. I am the dramaturg on it. And so I've gotten to do all kinds of wonderful research. And
I just have to stop. I don't understand how you can do everything. Like, I don't even understand.
Alana, you do everything as well. You do a lot of things.
I don't do dramaturgy. I do dermatology. I feel like, literally, like, anyone that you talk to in the theater has something they're doing with you or something that they are going to collaborate with you on. And I know you're an extraordinary writer. There's about 20 volumes of theater history that you are creating. The Untold Stories that Jen Tepper, is it four volumes or five volumes at this point?
There's three that are published, and I'm working on the fourth now.
Okay, so there will, by the time, listen, this is evergreen. Yeah. There will be like 10 by the time. Like, don't you just find her mind is mind-blowing. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. What's mind-blowing is that she's so good at all the things.
That's
it would be less
nice.
Impressive if she was, if she like half-assed it, or if she was, you know, she was okay.
I agree.
But if she was like the third best theater historian working today, it would be like, okay, I get how she can spread herself that thin. But no, it's amazing. She's just the best at all of it.
I feel like it's a very interesting moment in the community where people are, and I love this so much, people are becoming very well-known dare I say, famous within communities, not just because they're actors, right? Mm-hmm. Like there was a time that everyone knew the divas or the Tony Award-winning actors or were fans of people who they got to see on stage. Yeah. And what is making me so happy, and it's a brand new thing, is that people who write about the theater are hosting panels here at BroadwayCon with as many crazy fans coming to see them as the writers of the musicals and the people who play in them. And I want to, A, just say brava, because I think it's really important for people to understand how many different aspects of the business there are.
Yeah.
But for like the intellectual person to be honored in the same way is just for a parent and a human being on the planet. It makes me so happy.
Well, I really think you're doing amazing things to kind of like reveal the world behind theater and the arts. But it's also so much, we talk about the good things and bad things about social media. But one of the best things is that we used to only see the actors, right? Like you go to the show, you see the actors. You go read an interview about the actors, and I feel like social media has let you see more like the musical theater writers and the directors and the people behind the scenes, because it gives everyone just like that equal platform and a voice. Yeah.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. It's something that I wish, I mean, I guess I wish that I had it when I was a kid, you know, because like I was such like an obsessed theater fan. And so it feels so natural for me to be like, oh my God, there's, you know, Jonathan Tunick.
That's
and like,
right.
you know, like these
That's
people
right.
behind the scenes. And it's so incredible that now there's like kids who maybe wouldn't have that at their, hadn't previously had that sort of thing at their fingertips, that they're able to like appreciate this whole community.
I do feel like people are sometimes surprised to know that about Joe, because one of the other reasons we are like so tight and hit it off right away is like he is the hugest theater nerd ever. Like people think of him as like cool and he likes regular music, but I'm going to dispel that myth. Joe
Iconis like
loves Miss Saigon.
I do.
Well, that
he loves
is...
musical theater and like obscure musicals, all the things.
Well, we went to the library, right? Like when you were growing up and you're us, you would listen to cast recordings and you would go to your library and kind of, if you were obsessed, you had to really look for the thing or order a magazine, like a special American theater magazine
Course,
or something like that. That was like the porn of our time,
Yeah.
right? Like, oh my God, what's happening in the regionals? Ooh, like hide it under your blanket
at
night.
But
now there is this access and you can watch shows or snippets of shows on YouTube in ways that obviously were not accessible to people before.
Yeah.
But it is true that
I had this flashback yesterday because I moderated this panel about Show Business, The Road to Broadway, that amazing documentary about the 03-04 season, which was the season I like followed as a senior in high school. And the main way that I followed it was ordering Playbill magazine and waiting to get it once a month in Florida. Like that's the access people have to like be more chill fans on the internet. Like they know the next second after you've done a concert, which songs you did, they can listen to them on YouTube. It's amazing.
It's wild, yeah. It's crazy.
So what's better, like wait for it or immediate gratification?
I mean, I'm from the wait for it school of thought. You know, I like the sort of like purposeful build up to things, and it makes it feel special. And I like when you have to seek out things a little bit. But I think, you know, there's something fun about occasional immediate gratification, I guess.
So is Jen Tepper a character in any of the things you write?
She's definitely inspired characters and things that I've written.
Do you know which ones he might be thinking of specifically?
There's been a few moments in our friendship. Like, you know, Joe's not like writing an autobiographical musical, but there's a few moments in shows where you're like, oh, that's that conversation or that's that moment that I know Joe had. And there was a song during Black Suits that Joe wrote to me. He was in Barrington and I was in New York, and he was like, you're going to have a reaction to this song, this new song for Black Suits. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I'm less of a writer who's like, oh, this is this character who's based on this specific person. And more, I'm a big, like, I'll like clock things that people say and sort of store them away. And then, you know, 2 years later, they'll end up like as a line in a song. It's like that kind of thing.
So how did you go from, oh my God, I love Suddenly Seymour, to I want to write musicals that touch people and make people laugh and shock people and reflect a part of me that not everybody may know already?
So I, as I said, I sort of started with this love of going to see theater, right? And so I was like a fairly shy kid, you know? And theater was something that felt like the people who performed theater and did theater felt like sort of the opposite of me, you know, and I loved it. And so when I was little, I would be in shows because that's like the way that you can participate in theater when you're like six
did
or seven.
Did people tell you, like, Joe, you have a good voice? Like, when did you discover
that
you
could
sing?
No, because I didn't.
Sing?
They didn't tell me that because I had a terrible voice. And I was really scared to be in shows, but I loved being
Joe, you
there.
Have a terrible voice.
Yeah. Well, they didn't
I
say
like
that.
Listening
I
listening to him sing his song.
Yeah, I don't know why
I
they
know,
say
I,
you
yeah,
don't.
I can, like, anyway. Put over a song now, okay. But, like, whatever. But okay. I couldn't when I was seven.
Okay.
I was just,
fair enough.
Sort of terrified.
Okay.
And so even though I knew I wasn't good at it, and even though I could look at other people and be like, oh, that's like a really great singer, you know, at like age 8 or 9, I loved just being a part of it. I loved being around the theater. I loved the, like, making of the shows. And so as I was sort of, like, in things, the other thing that was happening with me is that my mom was forcing me to take piano lessons because my mom had a piano that her parents bought for her, and she never learned to play, and we had this piano, and so she was like, we have this piano. You're going to, like, take piano lessons because that's what you do. And I was taking them, and I was not really liking them. But then the more and more I got into theater, the more I started playing by ear. And so I would go see a show and I would go back to the piano and then I would like start playing, like,
plug
picking out the
out.
Melody, you know?
Yeah.
And then that's what sort of opened up music for me, doing that. That also what was happening was then I was just like reading a ton about theater. So like I was, you know, you talk about the library, like I was the kid who was like 11 years old and the only person ever to check out like the Broadway by the Year books. You know, it would just be my name like a million times. Exactly. It was like straight up that. It was like the fat Italian version of Bill.
He was the Bell of Long Island.
The Garden City Public Library.
Isn't this amazing?
Yeah, seriously. Yes. Just like taking out, you know, the book to like 70 Girls 70 and reading it. And so as soon as I realized, oh, there's people who write these things, that's what I wanted to do. And I have no idea why I glommed onto that as opposed to like being the director or being whatever, but it was just the writing was like, oh yeah, I want to do that. That's what I should do. And so then as I started playing piano more and more and like improvising and doing all that, I started kind of making up my own tunes. And so then when I was a little kid, I would be writing these songs without lyrics. I never wrote lyrics when I was a kid. And just making up these songs for like theatrical contexts, right? Or like I would write like a song and it would just music that would be like for the musical version of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, just like movies that I loved, you know?
So you'd imagine the musical version of things?
Yeah, totally.
Without lyrics,
yeah. I was always too scared to write lyrics. Because that was like putting yourself out there in a certain way that felt like a little bit too much for me, but I could like sit at a piano and just like play something, you know? And so then I was doing that more and more. I did it all throughout high school. In high school, I was like the kid who played piano for everybody. You know, I was the assistant musical director for all the musicals. And
were you still shy? Or was this a way to kind of be there and not have to worry about being social?
You know, it was a way to be there and not have to worry about being so social. And I definitely got more social, but I certainly was not like an outgoing guy. Definitely shy, you know, and I had my best friends, Mike and Kevin, who are still my best friends. They were like these like huge personalities and they sort of kind of swept me up with them, right? So I could like hang out with them and we all love theater. But I didn't have to like do that myself, you know? And so I sort of had that in high school. And
don't you wish Mike and Kevin were here right now?
Mike and Kevin are amazing, and in fact a little piece of Kevin is in the song Kevin. So speaking
of
autobiographical writing.
For sure, yeah, I named it for
like,
Kevin.
Is that the song Andrew Rannells?
Yeah.
Maybe not a little piece,
nice.
A medium piece. It's not true story.
Yeah,
it might be.
It's the kernel of the song was Kevin. Kevin in 2010. but yeah, so I decided I wanted to write musicals. In middle school, right? Like in middle school, my health class, our teacher had us write down what we wanted to do, right, on a piece of paper, and then she mailed it back to our class when we were seniors in high school.
Are you kidding
me? No, no.
I want to do that.
Yeah.
That's good.
It's a great idea.
Yeah.
It's a great idea.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to stick with it. I feel like if I was her, I would just forget or I'd misplace them and then have to like forge them. No, she did it. And I said, I want to be a Broadway composer. That's what I wrote when I was 12. And so...
That's pretty remarkable.
I think so.
What do you think yours would have said when you were 12?
I wanted to be the theater. Like, I wanted to be the theater. That's what I would always say. But George Salazar asked me earlier in our panel what I would do if I didn't work in the theater. And the only answer I have is being a waitress at TGI Fridays, because before I said theater, that was the only thing I wanted to be.
A waitress specifically Fridays.
I wanted to wear that outfit with, like, the pins and the stripes. So mine probably would have said that until I turned 9, and then my answer became, I would just want to be the theater.
It's kind of an amazing thing to be at Broadway Con, which is filled with dreamers, right? Like,
yeah.
All of us. And I feel like I still wake up every day going, I get to talk to Joe Iconis and Jed Tepper today. Like, there's something really amazing about building a life toward the thing that you want to do and finding ways to keep reinventing yourself in this world. And I think that Jen is someone, you know, I didn't mean to embarrass you when I said that, like, I cannot believe, like, of course you're going to do the dramaturgical work on this show, which is, like, makes sense to me because of how smart you are, how much you have written, right? You know, if you think about Malcolm Gladwell's, like, 10,000 hours and something, like, you've probably written 1 billion hours, right?
Probably.
At this point. But when you think about, you know, this collaboration that you're about to do and sort of working through ways in which to help the piece grow, what is that conversation like between the two of you? I mean, you're so close, obviously. It sounds like you could probably tell each other anything at this point, right?
We can. Yeah, I feel like we can.
Of course. Yeah, I feel like one of the most interesting things to me is, like, I'm the dramaturg on Love and Hate Nation, which I have never officially worked in that capacity on any of Joe's shows. But the things that I'm saying to him or the things that I'm researching are similar to things that are conversations we've had about other shows, even though just, like, it hasn't been that official title. And I think, look, like, my favorite thing about BroadwayCon this year is seeing all these Be More Chill fans, because my biggest dream is to just have people love Joe's shows as much as I do. And so anything that I can do to kind of support that, whether it's, like, promoting it or whether it's, like, dramaturging it, is, like, a conversation that I am excited to have.
Yeah.
What is this next show about?
It's
dramaturgically speaking.
Dramaturgically speaking, it's a musical that is a love story between two girls in a juvie hall for girls in 1962. And it's sort of about a group of young women who learn how to be revolutionaries.
And what was the inspiration for that particular environment for the show to take place in?
I had wanted to write something set in, like, a classic juvie hall for a long time, right? So it's sort of like a bunch of different ideas. So there was the juvie hall idea, and I had written a song that's sort of known as I Fell in Love in Juvie Hall. That's like a love song between two girls in a juvie hall. I wrote that a couple years ago, and I always thought, like, oh, maybe that could be something bigger than one song, you know? And then I got this commission from Penn State to write a musical for their senior class last year, and I could write about whatever I wanted. It just needed to be able to be performed by this senior class, and the makeup of the class was two guys and 7 gals. And so I felt like, oh, this is what I should use this to write this musical I want to write. That's all women, you know. And so that's kind of how it came together.
Okay, I don't think I will ever interview anyone who says I want to write a musical for all women. Like, who says that?
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting,
you're, like, the greatest,
like,
man on the planet.
Yo, thanks.
The leading role, which has been interesting for me to research and to watch Joe write, the leading role is a young black woman in 1962 who wants to be she's like an artist. She's like a musician.
Yeah.
And so to research her influences musically, to research what was going on for a young black woman in 1962, all of which both Joe and I have done, has been amazing. And, like, it speaks to our time in such a crazy way.
Yeah, for sure, you know. And as far as the writing something for all women, I feel like I'm always drawn to women, yes, clearly, yeah. But people who don't usually get musicals written about them, you know, and whether that's, like, one type of person or, like, a population or, you know, a marginalized population, whatever. And so to me, it feels like, why wouldn't you want to write? It's like a no-brainer, you know. And I see shows, and I've certainly written shows about, you know, white dudes before, I think, which is, you know, all well and good, but it just is boring to me, you know. And it's like, yeah, it's like there's other types of human beings in the world, and why not have them reflected on a stage, you know?
I've spent so much time reading about you and listening to you and kind of going through the history of your relationship and how many things you guys have done together and how it really is a love story between two people who love theater so much. And, you know, the thing about producing, which I've done a little bit of in my life too, is the joy that you feel when you give people opportunities to do what they do with all of the resources that they need to do it with, mm-hmm. and to give people opportunities to be great.
Totally.
And I feel like the thing about you, Jen, is aside from all of your own projects that are allowing you to be great as an artist yourself, you keep creating homes for people to work. And who is that?
That's Rob Rokicki, who's a really
fantastic
writer.
He wrote a lightning thief.
And he plays in my band.
He's walked by a couple times and stared at us longingly.
That. I feel like he should be here. I saw the lightning thief.
He's so good.
My 10-year-old was like, what?
My dream is to like kind of get people to like... to be an advocate for Joe is like so rewarding for me. And whenever I get to bring people to 54 Below who I'm like, you got to see this guy. And they're always like, oh my God, I loved that. It is so, that's so rewarding on musicals, on concerts. It's just my favorite thing.
Well, Will Rowland was saying that the thing that he's kind of excited about in terms of the power of his social media numbers is that he can talk about bowling for no reason at all.
Right.
And that he can tell people to go see your work.
Yeah.
And that he's kind of exploring like, okay, I wonder if that will be impactful. Like there's all of this fandom that happens, right? We talk about that a lot, sort of the power of social media. And it's one thing, it's really easy for people to hit like or the heart button. And it's another thing to like get people to actually buy a ticket or get out of their house and go see the thing and really figuring out how to take this platform that's an incredible community and fostering a love and familial feeling on the internet, but actually having it activate people in ways is something that, you know, I did an activism panel today and just talking about like if all the people who are doing selfies today instead like put out a message of, you know, love or something you could do today to like be a revolutionary. How do you kind of translate all of this energy around it to kind of seeing beautiful work and motivating people to, you know, become political? It's just an interesting time in that way.
There's this family of artists that Joe has created, and he also has like invested in so many of our friends who are actors before they had a shred of fame or a Broadway credit. And all of those people believe in his work because they have done it or they love it. And now they're all becoming more and more famous, and they advocate for Joe because like Joe kind of believes in people, myself included. Like I was 22 and had no experience, and he was like, yeah, come produce my concerts. And Will Roland was like right out of school, and Joe was like, come be in my musical. And George Salazar, Joe was like, let me hire you to work on a new musical. And it's like all these people, the more power we get, we're like, let's use that because we believe in this art so much.
Yeah.
I love you, Joe.
I know. It's so nice.
Is that heady?
I'll take it.
What is that? What do you do with that? Like you're the beacon. You're like the thing that makes them get out of bed in the morning.
I don't know. It's very surreal. You know, I think that the thing that I'm most proud of in my career so far is the people that I've surrounded myself with.
Yeah.
You know, like truly and the artists who I've been lucky enough to collaborate with. And so to see so many of those people now have success, or maybe they didn't have that sort of success, like the capital S success before, is that's totally rewarding. And it's mind blowing when then they want to use that success to try to like build me up and help. Yeah, it's wild. It's cool. But I'll take it. I will certainly take it. I need all the help I can get.
Joe kind of taught me, it's like kind of like a musical theater Steppenwolf, because Joe kind of, he like takes the sensibility of actors who he loves and like gets to work with them multiple times on different projects in that way. And it does, it just creates like a fabric of work that I don't see in a lot of other musical theater.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and for me that came out of like, in addition to loving theater, I'm a huge movie guy, you know? And so artists who I was obsessed with in my formative years, the biggest is Robert Altman. And I was so obsessed with Robert Altman in high school and in college, and the idea of like a repertory, you know, company, and the idea of like working with people who you love and creating an atmosphere of collaboration and party and all that, it's just something that like clicked with me, you know? And I was like, oh yeah, that's what I should do in musical theater. Like, why isn't anyone doing that, you know? And it's something that really that I still believe so strongly in, you know. And it was so funny, like when I sort of first started out doing things before people knew me, I felt like I was really battling this perception of like, oh, Joe worked with his friends. Like that's, uh-huh. Everyone would always be like, oh, him and his friends, you know, because a lot of times I'm working with these people who don't have a lot of credits, whatever. And so it's been funny to see the turn in the last few years, you know.
Like, can we get Joe and his friends?
Exactly, right, exactly. Totally. It's like a thing now, you know, which is so heartening. And like back in the day, I worked with Annie Golden all the time because she was someone I was really obsessed with.
Who I saw in the black suits.
Yeah, exactly. And she's, one of my muses, and I love her. But, you know, when I was in college, like, I just cold asked her to be in the first reading of the black suits, and she said yes. But, you know, like, back in the day, when people would be like, Joe and his friends, I would always have to be like, well, like, I didn't go to college with Annie Golden.
That's
you know?
Right, that's right.
And so, clearly, it's not just, like, me and my buds, you know, making musical theater. But it's been cool to see people not only tolerate my collaborations, but appreciate them. It's the way I know how to work, and it's the way I love to
work. It's also one of the things people don't understand about why our Christmas show gets bigger and bigger is because Joe also like welcomes all these new people into the family every year. And like, be more chill. What's beautiful is that like, I think when people respond to it, one of the things they're responding to is like Eric William Morris, who played the Squip, is like this incredible actor, incredible singer, but you know, he often gets asked to play like the hot guy role because he's like a hot dude. And like, Joe saw a lot of things in him that he kind of helped shape the Squip character. And the voice of the Squip character and the funny things about the Squip character, and people love that. But there's also all these actors in Be More Chill that like you didn't know before that weren't part of that family, sure, who now are part of that family because of that show. So it's a constant like grabbing new people and like utilizing those things about the people we've known a long time.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's the dream. And I think what happened, like when I started out, I was in a theater company called Naked Angels. And the reason we could
do that, Jonathan
mm-hmm. and so many amazing artists working today. And the reason we could do that is we had an artistic home in a physical presence. We had a mm-hmm. theater space. And that was a time where real estate in New York was just not what it is today. And you could find an old factory space that you could work out of. And so now, to have that kind of continuity where you have a theatrical home and it was a clubhouse, mm-hmm. right? Like it was this way in which, and now you are creating that for people. Like it's very fortunate that your friend runs 54 Below, because just having a space to go to and to work out of and to hang your hat on and to feel familiar with, to do the kind of work that you want to do with an audience that you know will come. Like that is a very magical thing that not everybody has. Like that home base is an extraordinary thing.
I love being able to have that. And what's really funny is I kind of have my job at 54 Below because of our Christmas show, because when I did that was when I got hired to run 54 Below. Like we did the Christmas show first before I worked there. So
wait, and they saw you doing that and they were like, okay, isn't that crazy? She could do that.
Joe refuses to take credit for this, but he has gotten me almost every job I've ever gotten, just because like when you work on something that you love and people see that you're passionate and that you're good at it, which I think I was doing all the stuff I did for Joe's shows, they want to hire you to do it. And that's kind of how that happened. And now it's like the owners of 54 Below, whenever Joe's there, they're like, we love this so much, thank you. And it's kind of, it comes full circle that way. And we get to do like Joe Iconis and family shows there, and Joe mm-hmm. and George Salazar are doing a show there coming up too. Yeah.
I just want to say that I could sit with you guys forever.
Yeah,
there's just
likewise.
So much to cover and so much to talk about, but there is also a lot going on at Broadway Con.
thank you for having us.
This is thrilling, and I just want to say thank you to both of you for kind of leading the charge and creating a new kind of theater community that is really about empathy and compassion and inclusion and friendship. And those are beautiful, beautiful things to chase. And I love your work so much. And
thank
I can't
you.
Wait to see what happens. And I can't really, I mean, not since Hillary, I guess, when is the campaign that I start working on? Jen Tepper 2020, I'm not sure where it's going to be. But I'm with her, is all I can say.
We're with you. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for being
on
the podcast.
And doing what you do.
Yeah.
It's really fun. I get to be inspired every time I sit down. And it recharges me in ways that are unexpected gifts daily. So thank you for being here.
Of course.
Okay, it's Broadway Con.
So much singing.
Good night, everybody. Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So there you go. These are little known facts that now you know.
If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says Contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast. And on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hanger Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.